This is MuggleCast, your Harry Potter and Fantastic Beasts podcast covering everything about J.K. Rowling's magical world.
Welcome to MuggleCast, episode 301. Micah, Eric, and Gina are here this week.
Great start.
I'm getting old. We've been at this for a while. How's everybody doing this week?
Good.
Great. We're in a new era for the show. Do you think we're going to make it another 300 episodes?
If you're doing them weekly, yeah.
Yeah, that wouldn't be too hard to do if we were back weekly again. Thanks to the support of our patrons. Anyway, people really liked our discussion last week, Eric.
Some people.
I told you people would like it.
It's nice to have once. Let's never do it again.
Eric had to go into therapy after recording episode 300.
Seeing someone regularly. Speaking of seeing someone, Andrew, did you win your toy?
Vibrating broomstick?
Yes.
No, I did not win it, unfortunately. I'm still searching for one. I'm surprised no one emailed. I would have expected one of our listeners to email and be like, hey, I've got one. You want it? I'll send it to you. Come on, somebody. I'll give you $20 for it.
Well, Eric said there's some great updates at the P.O. box, so who knows? Maybe somebody did send it to you.
Maybe we'll he's going to surprise me.
We'll get to that later in the show. Yeah. So you
Eric
were outbid.
Goes to the post office and pulls a broom out of the P.O. box.
Sorry, sir. This didn't fit in the box.
The mailbox is magically expanded. It's bigger on the inside. Actually, fun fact, whenever I get a package, because the mailbox is only a couple inches wide, they put a little slip in there and they store it in the back on like a bigger shelf. So
I want to get to the point where you start to record the reactions of the postal workers as they present you the things that are being sent to the P.O. box.
A live goat was sent to the P.O. box this week.
Listeners really are, though, all joking aside, topping themselves. We'll talk about it later, but I'm really excited to update you.
Cool. I'm excited, actually. Before we have some news to get to this week. We have an interview with somebody who visited the set of Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them for MuggleNet. Everyone here except for me spoke to Jessica before recording this week's episode, and we have that interview for you. We're also going to... This is more of a, I'd say, kind of like a grab bag type of episode, just a variety of things to discuss. But I do have to mention, Patreon recently launched an amazing new feature. If you've been on the fence about supporting us on Patreon, now is probably the time. So one of the kind of issues with Patreon and the content that we release there is that so we release these bonus MuggleCast installments, as we will be doing this month. We release two a month. And one of the issues has been that patrons can't listen to it through their podcasting app, through iTunes, through any podcasting app you use. You have to use the Patreon app or the website, which are both good, but it's not like listening to a podcast. Well, patrons now have their own custom RSS feed that they can pop into their podcasting app, whether you're on your desktop, your laptop, or your iPad, or your iPhone, or Android, whatever, and you will receive the bonus content just like you would new episodes of MuggleCast through your podcasting software.
Wow.
Yeah. I love Patreon. They've always really cared about the creators and the supporters, and this just shows you that they're really still working to improve the service to make it as great as possible.
Did somebody say game changer?
I was thrilled when they announced this. I was like, wow.
Yeah, you texted all of us. You were very excited.
I was super excited.
I've never seen you use that many exclamation points, actually.
Well, usually I'm a little nerdy, so when stuff like that happens, I geek out. But so please support us if you're not already. We'd really appreciate it. Patreon.com/MuggleCast. You'll get bonus audio that you can now receive right within your podcasting app. You'll also receive signed album art and many other bonus features, including the ability to stream the show, our recordings live. We have a bunch of people listening live right now as we record this week's episode.
Ooh.
And yes, chapter readings, as Eric mentioned. And thanks everybody for your support. If we get to our next milestone, we will be doing the episodes weekly. New episodes weekly.
It's within crazy. Our grasp. It's quite terrifying. Yeah.
We haven't done it in so long. We're a little...
I think it's probably been 7 years. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Little rusty. Micah, you're going to have to hop back into that newsroom and boot things up again.
There's a lot of cobwebs in there. And empty liquor bottles.
A lot of dead goats in there.
Oh, no.
Anyway, let's get to some news. J.K. Rowling, if you've heard of her before, I think, she recently teased on Twitter that the Patronus quiz is coming to Pottermore. But do we believe her? So somebody tweeted J.K. Rowling, first of all, you're simply amazing and I adore you. Second, do we have any time frame for the Patronus quiz on Pottermore? She replied, an announcement is very close. Now, that's great, but here's the thing. She's been promising the Patronus quiz for 2 years.
Oh, that's it? That's only 2 years?
It does feel like longer, doesn't it? Yeah, maybe. Yeah. The oldest tweet I found was from September 2014 when she said, keep watching Pottermore in regards to the Patronus quiz.
Jeez.
And then this past February, she said it won't be too long until we get to take it. So I don't know what the delay is, but I believe her. I want to believe her.
Yeah. Well, and it's also important to remember that an announcement is different than the actual test going live. So there still may be some time to wait after the announcement is made. She could say, oh, the Patronus quiz, you can expect it Christmas 2016. And then we'll see if it actually happens. But
Why announce it before it comes out? You know what I mean? Just release it.
Well, like if they still need more time with it, right? Because like they announced and released the Overmorning quiz like at the same time, right? That was one thing. But I guess the Patronus quiz is so high profile. Like people have been asking for this, I think, way back since we did the house quiz on Pottermore, because that was so special and immersive. The house quiz and the wand quiz were both integral to the Pottermore experience. And so we always kind of wanted more. And the fact that it's been, you know, X number of years, 6 years or something since, you know, Pottermore first came out and we still don't have this means, like, I'll take anything. I'll take an announcement, even if it's not an immediate release.
I bet we'll get an announcement this year, and the actual test will come out when that Fantastic Beasts book gets re-released. Not the script. The charity.
Oh, yeah.
New box set.
Yeah. Right. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, of all the I bet beasts. They'll tie it in with that somehow. But still, the word soon doesn't really... I don't believe... It doesn't mean anything at this point.
It's just like George R. R. Martin saying, "The Winds of Winter will be out soon."
Yeah. Which will we get first? That would be a lovely like bet or.
Let's do a poll.
Yeah,
which will come out first?
I'm gonna say the Patronus quiz is coming first.
I don't know.
I tend to agree.
So
with that.
I was thinking, what other quizzes would we like to see on Pottermore, written by J.K. Rowling? Because they do a bunch of these like BuzzFeed-y type quizzes on Pottermore, and they're not, you know, they're just throwaway content. But what would we like to see J.K. Rowling develop for the site? I was thinking, I did a little brainstorming, your animal that you get from Diagon Alley. Like,
oh, okay.
I think that would be kind of cute.
Didn't we do that though? When you got your stuff? Weren't you
on the old Diagon site?
Yeah, but it wasn't like a... But it wasn't a personality quiz, was it?
No.
Right. It wasn't like
you just got
it wasn't
to
like
choose.
Which pet would you be happiest with? You know?
Yeah.
Would be kind of like what you're saying. I think I like that idea.
People would love a bunch of personality quizzes written by J.K. Rowling to learn more about themselves in the wizarding world. So another example would be like the classes you should take at Hogwarts.
Oh yeah.
Or the teacher you'd most get along with.
I want that one.
I want one that tells you where you would live in the wizarding community. Like, what little, like, section? Like, Godric's Hollow or, you know, the outskirts of the borough. Or maybe you would live in a muggle area.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
I like that.
That'd be fun. Any other ideas before we move on to our listener suggestions?
I got nothing. I think the listeners are probably smarter and better at this.
And mine were so awesome.
Yours were great.
Yeah, Andrew.
The bar is really high.
Micah, tell us what some of our listeners said when you asked this question on Twitter.
So Nazima said, can we actually have owl exams?
Yeah, that'd be cool.
I would love that.
That would be horrible. I failed the wombat so miserably, I don't want the owls.
Didn't MuggleNet do tests like this?
I believe they do them every year.
Yeah, the gnomes. The gruelingly nauseating and onerous MuggleNet exams. I also fail them every year.
I had my dad try and take them once, and he was like, this is impossible.
No, but the exams would be cool. Yeah, the exams would be cool, actually, even though I said I wouldn't take them. I want the rest of the world to have them.
Those would be cool to tie into, like, the release of the encyclopedia, because if all that information is coming out at once, maybe before the encyclopedia is out, or like, okay, everybody read the encyclopedia, you'll be quizzed on it in 2 weeks, people would lose their minds.
Let me rephrase the question from earlier. Which will come out first, The Winds of Winter or J.K. Rowling's encyclopedia?
The Winds of Winter.
Yeah.
Now, I can't decide if this person's real name or their Twitter handle is more difficult to read.
Go for the Twitter, I guess.
So, at Biblio Bibuli says, what is the most suitable profession I would have in the wizarding world?
I like this. I like this a lot. Yeah. A quiz that measures whether you would be a good curse breaker or homemaker. That's what I, you know, that's what I want.
Yeah. I don't think Kyle, that's what they're saying.
No, but like, I mean, if you make a good R, you know?
Yeah.
Or other such professions.
Professor.
There you go.
Yeah.
Hey. Goat, hogshead, goat
bartender.
Fondler. Yeah, bartender.
There bartender, Eric. Remember, you were the one who didn't like the end of the last
episode.
Yeah,
so don't go there. I got it.
All right. Kyle says, very similarly, owls, but a quiz that would tell us what our magical strengths are. Example, he's good at charms.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I would.
And all these types of quizzes would let people have great discussions with their friends on social media and in real life. I think these would really get the Harry Potter fandom going.
Yeah.
Yep. Alex agrees with you, Andrew, says what magical creature I would take to Hogwarts.
Uh-huh. Yeah, see?
Tina also agrees about wanting a wizarding career aptitude test.
That'd be cool.
So does Kat, who says maybe what career I would have in the wizarding world. Lene would like to see a more extensive sorting hat quiz with all the questions instead of just some.
Does that mean, like, because when you take the quiz you get different questions each time?
Yeah.
I still don't, I think we kind of touched on this on a previous episode, but I still don't get why they give you different questions every time you take it, because I would prefer a complete sorting hat quiz as well. Right, so we know that everybody is on the same playing field.
Yeah.
And then Cornel Van Flutteren says sorting quizzes for all wizarding schools, if they have houses, of course.
I want that.
Yeah.
That's like, once they reveal all the information on all the schools, I want that.
Because Joe did a preview. Yeah.
Right. That is coming. That is happening. We got the Ilvermorny one.
We got the summary of all the foreign wizarding schools, too. The one in Africa, the one in Asia. We did get, like, blurbs on all of them, but not info as far as if there are houses, which there don't have to be, but if there are houses, you know, or how are the students divided, then a quiz on how that would work out.
Are we being too greedy? Like, do characters in the wizarding world, are they curious about what houses they would go into in the other schools?
I don't think they care about the other schools, so I think they're, like, it's kind of like, you're proud of your college and everyone else went to, like, the worst one ever. Like, you have pride, so you don't really care about what other house you're put into.
Yeah, that's true.
There have to be exchange students, though. Like, students who go to another one of the schools, maybe just for a year of learning.
Mm-hmm. Like, for the Triwizard Tournament?
Yeah. Yeah, but, you know, not once every 1,000 years.
Well, and that stopped happening now.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Finally found that out. Thanks to the cursed child. So, little other news. Thanks to everybody who participated in that on twitter.com/mugglecast. This is not directly Harry Potter related, but we'll get back to Harry Potter in just a brief moment. Corman Strike was cast for the Robert Galbraith mystery series that the BBC is doing with J.K. Rowling. Tom Burke is going to play Cormoran Strike. A lot of people know him. I personally didn't know him.
No. I don't know that I do either. I don't think we talk about Cormoran Strike enough on this podcast, because it's actually like a really good series that's written by J.K. Rowling. But this was big enough news that I'm glad we're talking about it. I do think that, you know, however I pictured Cormoran Strike just from reading the first book, you know, I think I pictured him a little older, a little less handsome. But I'm sure that Tom Burke will do a good job.
Mm-hmm. He's best known for the, I believe it's on the BBC, The Musketeers, that series. Right. A lot of people were freaking out. A lot of Tom Burke fans were very happy about this news. But as to his age, I thought this too. I thought Tom Burke looked a little too young, but then I Googled it, and Cormoran Strike is the same age.
Oh.
But I guess just the way you read Cormoran Strike in the series, he's just disheveled, and he's really he's a mess in general.
I think he's a little bit, I mean, when I read him, I feel like he's a little bit older than maybe he actually is. Is that what you're getting at?
He's in his mid-30s, just like Tom Burke is.
Micah, yeah, I know what you're saying, though, and I
agree. He reads as like...
He's been through a war.
He reads as sort of hard-boiled, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think this is cool news, and I guess now we'll hear about Robin, his assistant.
Oh, yeah.
Partner.
The news to come.
Yeah, and they are going to be filming later this year, and I guess it's going to premiere sometime next year. And they're so it's kind of going to be like a mini series. So they're shooting all three books that are out so far at once. And then each book gets like one or two episodes. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to this. And presumably this series is going to be around for a while, because J.K. Rowling is writing a few more of these books. The next one she's writing right now, she's been hinting on Twitter that it is moving along. But it does seem to be taking longer than the previous books. They were coming out a year apart from one another. Mm-hmm. And I guess just because of Fantastic Beasts and The Cursed Child and what other other projects she's working on, it's been slower this time.
I believe she confirmed that it comes out next year, because people thought it would come out this year. And I believe she said, no, you're going to have to wait till 2017. But there is a date in mind.
Cool. Are you going to say something, Micah?
Just that she was saying in a Facebook Live event that she did yesterday for Lumos that this year, 2016, has really been the year of her returning to Potter with Cursed Child and Fantastic Beasts and all the buzz that's been going on specifically around those two projects. So I think we'll probably get more focus on the Cormoran Strike novels, as Gina was saying, next year.
No. Stay in Harry Potter.
Stay in Harry Potter.
Can I ask a question, though? Of this group, how many people have read all three novels that she's written so far?
I have.
What?
Oh, have you guys read the Cormoran Strike novels, Gina and Eric?
I read one and a half.
I was waiting for Gina to finish the second one before moving on to the second one, because we have one copy between the two of us. But she never did, so I never did. So I'm blaming Gina fully for this. I blame you, Gina. This is me blaming you. I read the first one. I loved it.
I accept the blame.
This is the thing. I read the first one and loved it. And the premise for the second one, about an author who was writing like unpopular stuff and may have been whacked for it, was so interesting to me when it came out. And I really, really, really wanted, I had like such, I felt like such momentum, but then I never picked it up. I have full confidence that I will really enjoy these two books, but like, I have no good excuse for not having read them.
The second one got confusing to me. I think it was probably just me picking it up and putting it down on an unregular schedule, but I kept forgetting things. I'm like, I need to just quit while I'm ahead and then go back like now at a way later date and just start
over. Did you ever buy the third one?
I didn't, no. That's the only book I have not, like, the only J.K. Rowling book I've not rushed out and purchased. And I almost did, even though I wasn't done with the second one, just to say I rushed out and purchased it. But
This is my commitment to listeners of this podcast and Harry Potter fans, J.K. Rowling fans everywhere. I will read the second and third Cormoran Strike books before this BBC series airs.
Oh, yeah. You got to do that. And Micah, you've read all three, right?
Yeah.
Cool.
Which one's your favorite?
I was just going to mention how great the ending to the third one is, but I didn't want to go into any detail without knowing that everybody had read them.
A lot of people should say that. A lot of people said the third one is really good.
Which one's your favorite, Micah and Andrew?
I loved all three. I do think I would say one and three were probably my favorites.
Okay.
But two
so
wasn't
far,
bad.
I would say three. Like Harry Potter. maybe there's a connection there, but I'm interested to see how they're going to adapt this into 7 hours. But I guess if you were to make actual films of these books, they probably would be just over 2 hours anyway. So I guess that makes sense. But will they continue after Career of Evil, you know, and keep making these adaptations? And are they planning to? They may have announced this, but are they planning to bring it to the U.S. as well, or syndicate it larger than just...
It might be BBC America or
BBC.
Something.
They haven't announced it, but with the casual vacancy, the BBC and HBO kind of hooked up for that. So I suspect that it would come to HBO. But we'll see. Yeah, I mean, it's going to have to come to America. They can't not do that. Mm-hmm. So we will see and hopefully hear more about the fourth book soon. Rowling, by the way, said, "I'm thrilled about the casting of Tom Burke, a massively talented actor who will bring the character to perfect life. Cormoran Strike is pure joy to write, and I can't wait to see Tom."
Everybody's perfect. It's like we you'll hear this in a little bit. When we were talking with Jessica last night, I think it was a David
Heyman.
Or David Yates that was saying how Eddie Redmayne was the only choice that they ever had for Newt Scamander. So
if,
everybody's perfect.
So if Eddie Redmayne wasn't born, there would be no Fantastic
Beasts.
That's right. 100%.
Wow.
But also, just wanted to add something interesting that she also said during that Facebook Live was that, you know, in sort of the 7 year period plus since Deathly Hallows was released, you know, she had been writing a lot. She did the Casual Vacancy, the Cormoran Strike novels, and she also added some other things that I'm sure will eventually see the light of day. So, not sure what those are, but
I hope she
can clearly expect more from her.
I hope she went back to her childhood, the first children's story she wrote about a rabbit named Rabbit. I want that.
Oh yeah,
like full length 7-part series. That's what I want.
Such a clever name.
Also to James in the Patreon chat, I did read Casual Vacancy and I loved it, but I have not seen it yet. I just haven't been able to.
Me neither.
I haven't had the opportunity to.
You haven't seen it either, Andrew? You tweeted to Joe saying it made you smile or something and you made her blush.
I said it was a BBC memory that I cherish very much.
Of course.
The truth is better
than
my...
I haven't seen it in full.
Story.
Like I've caught it in parts, usually the second part. And, you know, I just... For me, with Casual Vacancy, I truly and honestly cannot remember what happens in that story. And so I feel like if I were watching it, I would have to go back and possibly read it again just so that I could better appreciate it.
Well, in the book, there is a vacancy that's casual. Let's get back to Harry Potter.
Harry Potter.
So Halloween season is upon us, and one of the Wizarding World parks is finally doing something cool with Halloween.
Right?
Wizarding World Japan has announced a bunch of Halloween-themed festivities. They have this thing going on with Death Eaters, a Death Eaters attack-type show. And what happens is, you have to watch video, but to get
the
to
video's
understand
amazing.
The full... Yeah, so like the lights fall on the castle and the Death Eaters come in and there's fire and spells, and it's kind of like a Halloween Horror Nights type of thing. The Death Eaters sort of take over Hogsmeade, and it's really cool. But it's not coming to the Wizarding World parks in the U.S.
I'm so angry about this because I went to Hollywood Horror Nights last year in Orlando, and I thought it was really cool that The Harry Potter section is still up and running and going, but it's not scary. So it's a great place for like the trade-off with kids. Like if the parents want to do Hollywood Horror Nights and the kids are too young to quite get it, they're in kind of a safe area where they're not going to get scared. But this is like the coolest thing where it's a little Halloween-y, but it's not, you know, terrifying. And I want this so bad for America.
And during the daylight hours, special spells performed and aimed at cauldrons and barrels at Hogsmeade will cause an eruption of candy to spill forth.
I just remember, like, with the Wizarding World in Orlando, and when it first opened, that first year, kind of trying to investigate and asking friends who had friends that worked there if there was gonna be anything for Christmas or Halloween, which is huge in Harry Potter, right?
Yeah.
But there never was anything. I think the closest thing I heard was that at one point there would have been a Christmas tree, but it might have got nixed due to different religious stuff. I'm trying to remember hardly, but you know, they never
but there's
really,
ways to they, celebrate multiple holidays, though.
Yeah, but they never really did anything, and I always felt that it was a missed opportunity. Even like September 1st, having some kind of party in front of Hogwarts for anyone who's in the park, you know, you never hear about this. And so this is the first time, 6 years later, 5 years later, you know, when we hear about a Universal Park doing something for a season. And the other, bit, of course, is the fall themed food items, which you can get in the Three Broomsticks in Japan, such as mountain shaped chocolate ganache and carrot cake.
Ganache.
And pumpkin gratin? Something? I don't know what that is. Yeah, like, it's just, this is stuff that should have already been in place, and now Asian fans will be very happy to and lucky to get it.
Cullen points out in the chat that Harry Potter isn't allowed to link to Hollywood Horror Nights. Like Joe said, I will never have that. This will never be a scare zone. This will never be scary. But I think this is a nice dip in the water, I think, to expand more during certain seasons, like Halloween and winter. It kind of what you said, Eric, I'm so surprised that they don't do more for Halloween in that section.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's true. And I think that maybe this is a testing ground of sorts for the Wizarding World to see how it's received in Japan. But just the fact that it is a missed opportunity, especially now that they have Diagon Alley, I mean, they could really deck the whole thing out for Halloween or for Christmas. And it doesn't have to be a scary environment by any stretch of the imagination. I mean,
exactly.
But you do have places like Nocturne Alley that you could use. And I just think that I'm sure there's a reason that we don't know about, but you would think that aside from just doing the celebration that they do every year in January, there has to be more marketing opportunities for them that they're not taking advantage of.
Eric, Cullen, by the way, tried to hook us up while we were at the Wizarding World, but we missed him.
That's right. But Greg did get us onto the train.
Yeah.
Which was very nice.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
By the way, I hear that hot butter beer is now back at the Wizarding World Orlando. So I'm flying out there to finally try this thing.
Are you going there?
No. But I would love to.
Andrew, if you go to the California one in the next like few weeks, ask them when it's coming, because it should be coming in it. October.
What do you mean? You heard that it's coming into the Hollywood one?
No, but I don't understand why it wouldn't.
Oh, because it's smaller and blah, 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 blah. I'm going to stage a protest in Hogsmeade.
I feel so bad that you've never tried this hot butter. The hot butter beer is seriously the best butter beer that the park offers.
I seriously looked that up before the show because I was like, oh man, that should be coming out soon. And I couldn't find anything about it for Hollywood.
Yeah. Call and mail me some. Thank you. Two other Harry Potter stories to talk about this week. To mention. Yep. There's not much to say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
First of all, Harry Potter, the exhibition is going to the Netherlands. So, people in the Netherlands, it's your time to check out all the Harry Potter props and stuff. Eric, this has been around for a while, though, right?
Yeah, it has. This has been like 4 years since we've talked about it on MuggleCast. I was surprised, though, in this press release. it's going to the Netherlands, but here are the places where it's been. And some of these places we never talked about or covered before. But it was in North America for most of it. It was in Boston, Toronto, Seattle, New York. But then also it was in Sydney, Singapore, Tokyo, Paris, Shanghai, and Brussels.
And it's probably going a million more places as well.
Belgium.
Come back to Chicago.
It's easy to forget, that this is out there with the, I think, much more publicized studio tour, which is, of course, Static. And, you know, it's at Leavesden, which fortunately, you know, I've been to. Andrew, you went, right?
Not to the studio tour. I went for set visits back in the Harry Potter days, but.
You gotta go. The studio tour in Leavesden is awesome, and I'm sure they'll probably do something for Fantastic Beasts, cause that's also being filmed there eventually.
Yeah.
Have you been to the Warner Brothers lot at Burbank at all recently?
Yes, they have a little Harry Potter exhibition.
Cause they have a room too, yeah. And then this exhibition's been traveling around.
The nice thing about the traveling exhibition is that it's really the only way for Harry Potter fans around the world to really experience the world of Harry Potter firsthand. You know what I mean?
Right.
Cause this is kind of, it's not a theme park, but it's, you can get up close and personal with these costumes, with these props and whatever else they have available. And that's really great for Harry Potter fans. So if it's near you and you haven't been to a theme park yet or the studio tour in England, this is a great thing to go to, I think.
I think we have a couple of patrons, actually, from the Netherlands. Write in. Let us know what you think of it, if you've never been before.
Let us know if a goat's on display. Micah, is a goat on display?
There wasn't one the last time that I went, but that was several years ago when it was here in New York. The one thing that I hope that they have changed that was an issue when it was here, and it probably was a case in the preceding cities, was that they didn't allow you to take photos, really kind of blows my mind, because I would think now with the studio tour being open to the public that maybe that rule changed a little bit. But maybe it had to do with the fact that not all the movies were released yet. I'm not sure.
A spoiler thing. I don't know.
But it made no sense to me. And, you know, we got yelled at for trying to take some photos. I would think that if you pay money to go and experience this, that
I don't know.
I will say it was a really cool experience to kind of walk through and see everything that they have to offer. I'm sure it's changed over the years a little bit, and it'd be great if they were to add some components of Fantastic Beasts to it as it continues to move around.
Yeah, that'd be great. I'll never forget the Bloody Baron outfit. That one was my favorite. Because the intricacy is just over, like, through the roof, and
it has half a second of screen time.
Yeah, half a second, and it's transparent, and it's in the background, like, flying through. So, completely ridiculous,
I'm fairly certain I have an illegal photo on Hagrid's chair, but I have no clue where it is.
Oh, nice.
You on Hagrid's chair would be about the funniest thing, I think.
My friend, you know her, Eric, Jana and I went, and Jana is the same size as me, which is about 90 pounds, 5 foot tall, so we looked pretty cool on that chair, let me tell you.
Speaking of delicious Wizarding World theme park treats, James mentions the Butterbeer ice cream, which I had when I was there in July. It is quite good. And that's another thing that's not in Hollywood. But they have chocolate and vanilla. It's like, how hard would it be to bring the Butterbeer flavor to Hollywood?
That's ridiculous. Do they not have a Florian Fortescue's?
No, because that's Diagon Alley.
I know they don't. Yeah, but they had Ollivander's and Hogsmeade.
Right. I mean, no, they don't. They got to bring the Butterbeer ice cream. Please. That's it. Please.
Yeah, the ice cream's fine. But seriously, though, hot Butterbeer, man. Hot Butterbeer.
Okay, stop. Stop. You're killing me.
I'm sorry.
Anyway, one other news story to talk about this week. Lego Harry Potter Collection is getting remastered for PlayStation 4. This was a big announcement from Sony when they had like a whole PlayStation 4 thing going on a couple weeks ago. Mm. Eric, did you play these games?
I did. Yeah, I think
they're
awesome. I have them both for Wii. They're really fun, and it's at times it's like with any of the Lego games, like you can go through the story or you can just have a lot of fun blowing things up with spells.
Yeah.
Collecting the studs.
I mean, the attention to detail is just unbelievable in these games. And, you know, we've spoken with Arthur Parsons, who was one of the leads on developing the Lego Harry Potter games back in the day. Mm-hmm. And I think it was Eric, you spoke to him actually at the Wizarding World.
Yeah, that's on a MuggleCast. I think there's an episode that's just, it's David Yates and Arthur Parsons from that park. And yeah, he talks about the level of detail, and like, that's the thing that shocks me with this announcement, because the two DLCs that you're getting, so it's, the remastered both games, which is years 1 through 4 and years 5 through 7, both games on one disc, which I don't know how they did, remastered, and then also the DLCs include 10 new characters. The funny part about that is that there are literally 500 playable characters in each of these,
oh, wow,
you know, games to begin with. Like, you wouldn't even believe, like, how many playable characters there are. And they somehow managed to find 10 that they didn't do the first and second time around.
What I remember is, like, everybody has an alternate form. So, you know, a Slughorn you can play as his armchair that he turns into, you know, when Harry and Dumbledore show up in Half-Blood Prince. But, the detail is unbelievable that they've gone into on these games. And they're all really passionate Potter fans. So they not only – it follows the movies, but the detail is really from when they went back into the books.
And yes.
They're really – passionate about the story itself. And I actually remember when I was playing the games, like, I would direct message back and forth with Arthur Parsons asking him, like, oh, how do I unlock this? How do I unlock that? And so it's cool to see that they're doing this remastered version of it.
Okay, so I have a PS3. I never, ever, ever use it. I used to use it for Blu-ray. But even that I don't anymore. And maybe I'll buy this game and finally play a video game on the PS3. Because this looks fun, and it's only $20 on Amazon.
Just get the PS4 version, because you're gonna get
but I don't
PlayStation
have PS4.
I know, but it's worth it, because PlayStation VR is coming out at end of this year, and it's gonna be absolutely stunning.
That's not for me. I don't like virtual reality.
No,
no, hell no.
I don't like my senses being taken away.
Yeah, I like to live in the real world. I don't need this virtual reality.
Okay, all right. To each their own. But
one final question I do have about this is, would they consider making a Fantastic Beasts version for...
Probably.
If that's not on the way, I'm...
It's probably on the way. It's gotta be.
That would be amazing.
They'll probably
pose the question
until, like...
I did not get an answer yet.
Well, how about you message Alan Parsons and ask him?
Arthur,
I'm sorry.
Alan is...
I did ask him. I haven't gotten an answer.
Oh, okay.
Remember,
I'm sure he can't say.
Remember, they're still doing Lego video games for Star Wars The Force Awakens and the Marvel movies, and Jurassic World. So you bet another Harry Potter
pipeline. Once Lego has the rights, and it probably made them $1 billion, they'll probably go back. I don't know if they'll wait, you know? I don't know if they'll wait until, you know, 3 Fantastic Beasts films are out or what, but
yeah,
they can't come
that's
soon
possible.
Enough. Maybe that's, like, also one of the reasons they're remastering this, is to, like, remind people that this was a thing and
it exists.
Well,
this is for Dimensions, I believe. Or is this... This isn't
no,
Dimensions?
No, it's
not. Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's
They are adding Harry Potter stuff, new Harry Potter stuff, to Dimensions, which is something completely different, but...
It's like their open world...
Yeah.
Thing where you mesh a bunch of characters into one world from different.
I gotta catch up on that, because I wanted the portal dimensions, but I never looked into it.
So speaking of Fantastic Beasts, let's move on to our interview.
Yeah, so this was an interview we did with MuggleNet.com's news manager Jessica Jordan, who in December visited the set of Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. And we were mentioning earlier too, like, she wasn't able to record or take pictures or anything like that. She basically just had a notebook and was forced to write down everything she was seeing as she was seeing it. So this interview talks about some of the places she saw. There was a very interesting room that she was led into for the interviews, which we'll talk about towards the end. But it's really just a nice talk and insight into the upcoming Fantastic Beasts. We are here with the head of news stuff for MuggleNet, Jessica Jordan, who recently, or when did this happen, Jessica?
Man, at the beginning of December 2015.
Oh, wow. Okay, over 9 months ago, babies have been conceived and been born since this happened. but it was a... Jessica, you got to visit the set of Fantastic Beasts, and we are just finding out about this now because you posted a comprehensive 12-article recap of what you found, saw, and heard over on MuggleNet.
Yep.
Well, first of all, nice work. It was a great joy to read all of that stuff.
Oh, thank you.
And I'm interested to see how this all compares to what Gina saw as well.
Oh, yeah. We have a little surprise up our sleeves, Jessica, because Gina actually saw the test screening that came out in Chicago a little while ago.
Oh, cool.
So both of you ladies know more about the film than Micah or me.
We collectively know too much.
So much. So much. But the good news is, unlike Gina, Jessica, you're able to, the embargo's lifted, right? So you can talk about what you saw on set.
Right, yeah. I probably saw, you know, much less than was revealed at the test screening, but I am allowed to talk about what I did see now.
So what, to you, was, you know, some of the highlights of the sets? You talked about going through the Central Park Zoo. You talked about going through sort of the Lower East Side of Manhattan and the Macusa, right, building?
Oh, yeah.
What sort of to you really stood out besides the fact, I'm sure, all of it?
Right, yeah. So the two that I really liked the best were Macusa, obviously, because it was really the grandest set that we visited. A lot of the other ones, you know, it was cool to see because it was very sort of movie magic, but it would be, you know, just like 50 feet long and it's like, wow, they're going to film the whole thing in here. But, Macusa, they had really put up this big grand hallway and they had all the like desks of the, you know, magical bureaucratic workers, like covered in memos and everything. And it was just a really, nice time to sort of get to walk around and really be inside the world, because all the other ones we did was very much like, I am on the set of Fantastic Beasts, and that's so cool. But in Macusa, it was a big enough set that I was like, whoa, I'm in Fantastic Beasts.
Were there sections of Macusa that you could kind of go and touch and look a little more into and onto? Or was it, you need to stay behind this line and look around?
Oh, they let us go everywhere. I mean, it wasn't, you know, it's not the whole building. It's sort of the main entry hall, and then bordering the hall were a bunch of desks, but we were allowed to walk anywhere. And so, you know, we could go to the desks and read, you know, they had all kinds of things like, you know, paper airplane breakout on level 4 and, you know, threat level assessments and like urgent meetings. You know, we were allowed to read all of sort of the little things that had been created to lend the set a sense of authenticity. So there really wasn't anything that was off limits for the things that they showed us. But I do think that most of what we were allowed to see is kind of peripheral to the main story, because they weren't going to give us too much.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, what about that statue, though? There's a picture that we have here of a Salem witch trial statue, and it reminds me a bit of what we saw when the ministry had been taken over, that magic is might because of the solemnness of it. So I was wondering if there was sort of any comparison there, or you thought of that when you saw that.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what I thought, actually. I was like, whoa, it's like the American Fountain of Magical Brethren or something like that. And it was actually a lot of fun. One of the things I was going to mention, that the fun part about the set visit, or one of the great things, was that you got to kind of be a detective, because they would take us into these places like Macusa and some of the other ones, and they would be like, here, you know, look around, but they didn't tell you anything. you know, you could kind of glean one or two things if you're just like chatting to the representative who was leading us around, but they're very tight-lipped. It's like, here, you can look at this, but we're not going to tell you what anything is or how it's used in the movie or anything like that. And so when I was there, I was like, wow, and maybe, you know, I wonder if this is a Salem memorial, because like they look like they're in Puritan clothing and like, you know, drawing all these connections to the little bit that we had learned. You know, think back to last December, we knew almost nothing about the movie. And then, of course, just a 2 or 3 months after the set visit, when I still wasn't allowed to say anything, Pottermore like released the piece on the statue with like the picture of it, and they were like, the Salem Memorial statue. And I was like, I knew that, and I wasn't allowed to tell anyone.
That's great. The other thing that it just impresses me is you talked about feeling a bit like a detective, but they really only let you take in a notebook, right? To like mm-hmm. write down what you were seeing.
Yeah. I thought
so, like, you had to be really observant.
Yeah. Well, I tried to be. I was writing, you know, furiously, and I wrote the report. You know, 2 of the 12 articles were just like, this is what I saw. I wrote that immediately when I got back. Because I didn't want to forget anything. I didn't want to forget anything. So I took as detailed notes as possible and then just wrote it right away. And even going back and getting it ready for publication, I was like, oh yeah, I kind of forgot about that.
Now, is it true you walked from an accountant's office to a frozen lake? I mean, some would say that they could be one and the same, depending on...
Oh, Micah with the accounting joke. Zing!
Yikes! All the accounting listeners are...
fronted. We're going to get hate mail now.
Well, the reason I bring that up is because I think we did see a scene from the lake in one of the trailers, didn't we?
Yeah.
There was something luminous beneath the lake.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, but, that is correct.
Yeah, you can. I think I put in a couple of screen grabs from the trailer, because, of course, when they showed it to us, it was like the most nothing set. You know, we had just walked through New York and whatever, and they're like, oh yeah, and here's, you know, the lake set. And it was literally like, it was in winter, and I had been coming from Massachusetts, and I was like, this doesn't look like much. You know, it's a frozen lake with a bridge. I can just see that at home. But then it was exciting in the trailer. You did see, as you guys noted, there's something sort of glowing under the ice. And there's a moment where Newt kind of thrusts like a helmet thing into Jacob's hands and is like, you know, your skull is fragile and something. So,
yes, the photos you posted are I agree. They're very accurate to
what must be going
are.
On
yeah,
in that scene.
the screen grabs were very apropos.
You're still under embargo, aren't you?
I know. I'm trying to have a good poker face.
It's hard.
It's very hard. But I will say the artwork that you found of just New York in general from the 20s matches what you see in the film, which honestly, I don't think that's that big of a giveaway, because if you pause and screen grab the trailer enough, you're going to see these images and you're going to say, yes, right. That looks like that. So.
Yeah. Yeah, that was one thing, too, that was kind of neat. It was like, well, I'm not getting anything from Warner Brothers that I can post, but, you know, I can just leave this postcard of early 1900s New York here and form your own conclusions.
That train station, the bit about the train station in part two of the set report really, 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 really stuns me. Because you talk about Stuart Craig not even being able to get access to the actual, is it the City Hall train station, which is right near where Micah works, I imagine? You know, still in existence, kind of. I assume it's in disrepair, but it's closed. Like, the fact that Stuart Craig couldn't even get access to it, and they had to build a set that was a replica of it, but, you know, based on, I'm sure, 100-year-old city documents, like, that's just really cool simultaneously to see that all of these sets were rich, like so rich in detail, but there is an element of guesswork to it all the same. And like the fact that they're recreating New York, but not filming in New York, because New York today wouldn't even look like it used to. All of that is just kind of, I think, movie magic at its finest.
I mean, you're talking about 90 years ago.
Yeah.
So I would think, I would hope that New York would be a little bit different. But you know, in reading Jessica's, the interview that you had posted with David Yates, I mean, talking about this exact point that they did a ton of research and development specifically to 1926. And I think that, you know, from everything that we're hearing, and Gina, maybe you can lift the embargo slightly here, from what you saw, in the film, did it seem like you were in the 1920s? And same goes for Jessica when you were on set.
Jessica, you go first.
Okay, sure. So one quick thing about the City Hall subway. It is astounding that they weren't able to get in, considering these are pretty much some of the hugest names ever, that they couldn't even
Who are they opening it for? Who can go down there? Well, that's what I want.
Clearly, Joe not say, like, hi, I'm Joe Rowling. Can I get in that subway, please?
The thing is, I guess not. But it was confusing to me, too, because some people have gone down there in more recent years. Like, I think many of the photos I put into the article were photographers who, you know, that type of internet article that's like, you know, gaze into this abandoned subway station,
like
amazing type of thing.
Yeah.
Where they had gotten in somehow. But yeah, I don't really know too much about that. But it did feel a lot like the 1920s. Like, it was very exciting when you're sort of walking through the city streets, all the shop windows. You know, in department stores, it was 1926 fashions, and in the little diner we stopped in, it was 1926 prices for food. So, you know, like 10 cents, things like that.
Good luck with that in New York now.
Yeah, right. So yeah, they paid, you know, this is what everybody says about the Harry Potter and now the Fantastic Beasts films, is that the production just pays so much attention to detail. And that was definitely true from what I saw.
Yes, when I saw it, that was one of my, like, favorite things about it, was immediately I knew where I was, I knew what time it was. I that was one of my favorite parts, because I love that time period and the fashion, and it was, that was one of the unspoken characters of it, was the fashion, I think, and that really brought me into it, as well as when the camera's kind of going down the street and you just feel like you're there.
Mm-hmm.
It's no surprise to all of us, I'm sure, that the sets were in fact this detailed. Of course, it's nice to get the reassurance. But in building the set too, like, it's just ultimately, you know, a set is what the actors can play on. So I like that it's probably, and I think you'd said this, Gina, when we asked you earlier, but, you know, it's kind of a marriage between the set doing the talking for the time period, and also the actors who can play older or characters from long ago, that I'm sure it's, you know, I'm sure it's sort of both aspects that make you, that really immerse you in this time period.
Yes. That's, yeah, that was kind of what I was saying before, in the previous episode when I spoke about it, and now, was, yes, I felt like it just looking at them, looking at the space, but then when certain characters come out, you knew where you were. I had a question about detail for Jessica, though.
Sure.
Was there any detail anywhere on any of the sets that like just struck you and you thought that was the coolest added detail?
Oh man, let's see. I mean, there were so many things. I guess, again, to go back to Macusa, the thing that, well, and in the accountant's office, too, because they had a lot of different things lying around. Like, there was one piece of paper that was just, like, the scale to convert. I can't even remember what they were. If I had my notebook with me, I could look it up. But just, like, some invented thing, and it had, but it was, like, a whole system of things worked out. And honestly, I don't know that that's going to be, like, featured in the movie, but just all the things there that aren't a part of the main plot that they had took the time to imagine and then put there were really incredible.
Yeah, you wrote about the newspaper headlines, obviously the ones that are a little bit more tied into events from the film, like manholes burst from the streets in freak incident, experts stunned. You know, but like all of this other stuff about witchcraft, about sort of the peripheral, what the wizarding world is facing. You had a brilliant line in here somewhere about it's clear that, you know, Newt's issue aren't the only problems that this Wizarding World is experiencing, that there are other completely tangential, you know, issues that are being covered that you can see, you know, if only you can look closely enough at, you know, this other sort of desk paperwork and these other newspapers here.
Yeah, it was, I don't know, it really did. And one of the actors had mentioned, probably more than one of them mentioned in their interviews too, that everything that the production team put on the ground for them helped bring those performances out of them. So, you know, they would, action would be called and they'd walk onto the streets of New York and you could see like a couple having a fight or somebody changing a tire. And that then that puts them in that world, you know, they, then
Catherine Waterston discussed that. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was who it was, but I was like, oh, what if it was Alison Kendall? And that's just really incredible. And it's true too. They're allowed to say much less about the wizarding aspects of things, but I'm sure that carries over to those kind of sets too. It's like, it's a lot easier to talk with a straight face about your, you know, wand waving abilities when it's all around you.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the benefits too. And I know we've had the discussion about you bringing back David Yates, but the fact that you have David Heyman and Yates and Stuart Craig and a lot of the same team that produced the Potter films, I think the level of detail was so important to them when they were going through and creating the first 8 films for Potter that it seems like there's a lot of that carryover for Fantastic Beasts.
Yeah, definitely. I'm happy that they have so much of the same team because I'm not really the biggest fan of the Harry Potter movies. Like, obviously, I went to see them all, and, like, I've developed a fondness for them over the years, but, like, I really loved the books, and so the movies in some ways were letdowns to me, except in the ways in which the Wizarding World was designed and executed. And so for Fantastic Beasts, I'm super excited that they have that team coming back, because they did such an amazing job the first time, and this time they don't have to adhere to a book, you know? They can write for a film, and so I think it's going to be really incredible.
Yeah, it really seems like their talents are most suited this time around.
Mm-hmm.
I see exactly what you're saying there, and I think, yeah, that's sort of my hope going into Fantastic Beasts as well, that it's just, you know, because it will only exist as is. Although I know we're getting also the screenplay sent out, but, you know, whatever. I have to say also, I love in the interview with David Heyman, all of the nice things he had to say about everybody. He's just like such a cheery guy, and like he had a lot of in-depth stuff to say about the characters. Like this you can't call it a trio, I guess. Did anybody ever really call it like the quartet?
I think some of the press, we were trying to find a quick hand to refer to them. So I think we may have thrown about quartet a time or two.
Quartet.
You could just say squad.
Trio. Oh, squad. Yeah. Trio was so easy that I look at it and I'm like looking back. It's like trio was what they were. They were the trio. So these four actors, Heyman, discusses that they're the sort of the characters are all outsiders, which I thought was really cool. And he draws the comparison between, sort of, the other characters like the trio who had, you know, were outsiders but found each other. And I'm sure that has to do with like the plot of the movie. But for me, it also, I think, connects to the audience. And I think who goes and sees these sorts of films, and like, look, gone are the days when we would be, chastised or thought geeky, you know, for liking Harry Potter. I think Harry Potter's come around, you know, the world has come a long way since even 15 years ago. But I thought that really resonated with me, and it seems cool that, like, from what the actors too said about each of their characters, that, you know, these are characters who they're set apart by time, but they're, you know, there's still a lot of relevance there, for like today.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's very true. It's sort of, you know, I hadn't thought about it in that way until he was sort of speaking to it. And then it was like, you could tell just reading between the lines, even of what everyone else was saying, that it was really an underlying theme, like probably something they talked a lot about in a, you know, script read throughs and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. One of the other things too, and this kind of falls in line with what you were just talking about, but specifically for Newt, right? It was saying, Heyman said that he was more comfortable with creatures than with people, most likely. And it, that ties into the whole kind of outsider, piece of it, right? It reminded me a little bit of Bill Weasley.
Yeah. Or Charlie, too.
Or Charlie, yeah. Sorry. Charlie, yeah, Charlie, not Bill. Yeah, yeah. Actually, both of them.
Probably both,
nah,
yeah.
Bill was cool. Bill was fine with everyone.
I don't know. He locked himself up in tombs in Egypt for years. But no, the other thing Heyman said about Eddie was that he was their first and only choice for Newt.
That was fascinating to me.
I don't know how that's possible. I mean, I get it, but I kind of also don't get it.
I call... Oh.
Yeah.
I wondered how true that statement was. I think he is what they wanted, but I don't always believe the one and only choice for casting.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised by that too, and I think probably only, you know, just a little bit disappointed. I was with a lot of other people. I was very excited to see what they might do with Newt. That maybe they would cast an actor of color, or they would cast somebody who was, you know, unknown. That they had an opportunity there to make something really, really interesting happen. And Eddie Redmayne, obviously, you know, I wasn't really convinced until I saw the pictures come out. But of course, it looks like he's going to be amazing as Newt, and it's nothing against him, but it was when David Heyman said that, I was like, really? You never even thought about doing something a little bit more outside the box?
I can see how that's a double-edged, like, saying that would be a double-edged sword, because it does excite you to, like, see him in action.
Yeah.
He said, here's another quote from Heyman, you don't cast someone for their silhouette, but he's got a wonderful silhouette.
Yeah.
That tall, thin, dot, dot, dot. And he's great. So we began with him.
That's just like in the Fantastic Beasts book, the drawing of Newt is a tall, thin, older wizard.
I don't remember this drawing at all.
I do. Maybe I'm thinking of something else. I could be very wrong, but I thought that was a drawing in the book. So I did kind of picture him as taller and thinner. I don't love Eddie Redmayne. But I think he and the rest of the cast were picked perfectly. I really do.
Well, it certainly seemed that way from these interviews too, that they like, Heyman also talks about Queenie, and how Allison Sudol, like, when she smiles, the world lights up. Heyman has a lot of really nice things to say about everybody. But yeah, like it seemed like they really found a cast that they were able to like, this whole production, I don't know. I would have just died if I went to Leavesden and saw this and heard everybody saying such nice things. I would have just died.
It's interesting that you say that about the cast, because I think there's a part in the Yates interview where he wasn't entirely sure about coming back because, you know, everyone went their separate ways at the end of Potter.
Right.
But it seems as if they've found sort of the foundation of a new family within the wizarding world that they can now move forward with. And that's not always the case. I mean, anytime you do spinoffs, and I use that term lightly for Fantastic Beasts, but, you know, it's always going to be considered part of the Potter world, even if Harry has absolutely nothing to do with the storyline. So I you know, it's, I'm sure they did a fair bit of research, even if Newt was the first pick from day one, no matter what, in putting this cast together. So Gina, the fact that you said that they cast them perfectly, it's good news.
Yeah, there's definite chemistry with, the quartet, I feel, but
nothing else can be said.
There's one thing, Jessica, before we let you go, I want to ask, and we'd be remiss if we didn't, and I'm sure our listeners would hate us. I want to ask about the Beasts, because tell us about this room that you went to with all this concept art.
Oh yeah. I mean, this was amazing. This was this was a treasure trove. They took us, when we left sort of the outside set, they were like, okay, now we're going to go do a couple interviews. And so, you know, we're just following them around the massive Leavesden lot. Like it's unimaginably huge through corridors and things. And we get to this room that's locked. Like, we're supposed to have interviews in there, but it's locked. And so, you know, the people leading us around have to, like, call and, like, get in. Like, clearly there's some top secret stuff in here because it's not just left open. And it's just a boardroom, like a meeting room that you might find in any office. But every wall is just papered with different concept art and props from the film. You know, one section of one wall was all the beasts that I mostly... You know, I tried to copy down the names of everyone and where I could just do like a succinct, this is kind of what it looked like. But there were also things like you have to have, there were wand permits for Tina and Queenie hanging in there, which had all kinds of fun information like their height and their address. You know, we had seen the apartment set earlier from afar, and then it's like, well, I'll write that down because that is where, that is the address of that apartment. Posters, like, I think I mentioned some of the wanted posters that were hanging up there, scenes of sketches of different sets and characters, and just more than you could take in, really, you know. So they let us look around for like 5 minutes, and then they brought in David Heyman, and then it was just, you know, focus on the interview. Like, don't give them too much time to look around.
You took in so much. Here's the wanted posters I'll just mention right here. The wanted wizards were Ernestia Abator, a.k.a. Red Panther, Jeremias Wardcut, quote, bearing wand, most menacing and extremely dangerous, and Lancaster Pike, a.k.a. Magic Joe, wanted for embezzlement of spells and nomad murder. So, right? It doesn't even, like, even if these characters don't show up in the film, that level of detail is insane.
Right, yeah.
Very Death Eater-like.
Yeah.
My one question about this room, did it appear as though they had taken things down for you? Like there were holes in the walls?
You know,
like, blank space on those walls? Like,
space on the walls?
It didn't look like they had taken things down, but I think, as is the nature with such rooms that are meant probably for brainstorming, that there's often, like, things on top of things and stuff like that. And so, okay. I think that it wasn't like, there's a hole here, like, they have concealed some important information
Yeah. That's why I was like,
right.
I wonder.
But they,
were there beds in there?
Could have, you know, like, oh, well, we'll just, like, take this little thing down. But, I don't think that they did, but who knows? Who knows?
Mm-hmm. Were there beds?
No.
Because I'm assuming, like, this is where that they locked up Stuart Craig and his design team.
Right?
Like, weeks on end.
You know, thinking about it, I'm not even sure what this room was. It must be, you know, some kind of type of place where they had meetings about what was going to happen in the movie, but it definitely, it wasn't like the design workshop. Like, man, I would have loved to have seen that.
Mm-hmm.
Have to wait till they open the Fantastic Beasts leg of the studio tour, I guess.
Yeah.
I have one other question. I really want to know more about the blind pig.
Mm. Right. Yeah. I mean, there's not so much more, I think, besides that it is the wizard speakeasy. From watching the trailers over and over again, trying to get my screenshots, there's a moment where Catherine Waterston is wearing, like, this beautiful gown. At first I thought that maybe she and Newt were going to, like, that fancy fundraiser, because we had seen sort of on the news side of things, extras dressed in, like, fancy clothes at one of the Liverpool sets. But after watching the trailer over and over again, I think that that is her and Newt going into the Blind Pig speakeasy. And you could see in the trailer when she knocks on this door with, like, this blonde woman who, like, winks or something. I think that's the secret entrance. And then you do get a glimpse inside of sort of the goblin who runs it. played or, you know, voiced by Ron Perlman, and you can kind of see his the resemblance of his features in the character there. And then there's, I know there's a band that plays. I think that the concept art maybe had the band information, but I'm not recalling it right now.
Well, they need to make this thing happen at the Wizarding World in Orlando sometime soon.
I'm sure it's coming. It's just slowly going to take over the entire park.
Universal Studios of Harry Potter.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, Jessica, I want to thank you very much for setting aside the time during your big move, cross-country, no less, to talk to us about this set visit. And I want the listeners to know, again, there are a dozen articles on MuggleNet. They're all collected together. Check it out. It's called MuggleNet Visits the Set of Fantastic Beasts, and they're all by Jessica. Published earlier this week on the 12th, and really just amazing, amazing detail, fantastic work.
Great interviews.
Great interviews. Super impressed with everything you've done, and thank you for being so generous with your time and talking with us.
Of course. It was very exciting. I've had to be quiet for so long.
Shout to the heavens how cool it was.
It was so cool.
There you go.
And we'll be sure to put links to your reports and your interviews in our show notes.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Jessica.
Yeah, I thought that was really insightful. Micah asked a lot of good questions, and actually, Janet, you did too, about all that stuff. And I'm still curious about that statue and about what that means in Makuza.
More to come.
If anything, yeah, it made me more excited for this film, which is only 2 months away.
So let's move on to a couple of questions we have from our dear patrons. We asked on Patreon in the past week, what do you want us to talk about? We got a lot of feedback. Our Patreon community is really active, which is amazing. Thanks to everybody who keeps submitting questions. We're going to do a couple of them here, and then we're going to do the rest in Bonus MuggleCast for September. This first one comes from Gregory. Now, people, again, our community is very engaged, and we love that, but people are writing long messages, and just for podcasting sake, it's not best to read the full messages. So from Gregory, a part of his question, he said, I'd like to know what is your opinion on movie adaptations of the books, specifically about having a good adaptation versus a good movie. What do you think is more important in the context of this series and its movie versions?
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's just important to add that he goes on to say, and to your point, Andrew, I'm just summarizing, that he really enjoyed the third movie. I know it's not one of our favorites, or at least for the most of us on the show, it's not. But he brought up a lot of good points as it related to it being a good movie versus being a good adaptation. Yeah.
This question, and specifically like feedback about the third movie, it always rubs me like the wrong way or ruffles my feathers, because I probably agree with the idea that the third movie is the most cinematic, or that at the time it was certainly the best real adult movie. But I always side on the line of adaptation matters the most, because if you have these books, which are just unstoppable fun, and if you were true to them and adapted them, it wouldn't, no matter what, would not come up with a shitty movie or a sucky movie or an uninteresting movie. So I do still hold Prisoner of Azkaban accountable for all the things that were left on the cutting room floor and not adapted, and I'll never get over it. What do you guys think?
I think what's most important is just getting across the messages of the book.
Right.
What was J.K. Rowling trying to tell readers? What are the themes? What messages did she want the characters to get across? Adapting those. We know, we've spoken time and time again, that the movies are not perfect adaptations of the books. And it's actually kind of funny we're talking about this right after this Fantastic Beasts set visit, because I know in some of the interviews conducted on set, one of the things that Heyman, the producer, and Yates, the director, was saying was, thank goodness we're not adapting a book this time, because there are no expectations like that. What you see is what J.K. Rowling wrote. It is a 100%. It's an adaptation, 100% of her script. So I think what's most important is getting across the messages, including some classic lines. You have to do that, because people just really love these books. And not diverting The Harry Potter movies, say what you will about them as adaptations, but they never diverted away from the books, truly. You look at House, but you look at what's happened to Divergent, for example. That has gone so off base from what Veronica Roth wrote in the books. It's just disgusting.
Really? Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And probably ultimately sank the
franchise and the fandom.
The franchise, yeah. My issues with the Potter movies are when they change things for no good reason. Like the third movie I have such anger towards because they changed and added in certain things that were unnecessary in my mind to let go of things that I wanted in the movie. So
I always think they really tried hard to come up with explanations. Like the thing with the third movie that they always say is, Quaron convinced and everybody wanted to make a movie that like specifically focused on Harry's journey. And somehow the story of Harry's parents being friends together at school with this killer, wasn't part of the Harry cinematic journey. But that's at least what they say, that, you know, anything that was not directly related to Harry being a teenager and struggling, was nixed, and that's their sort of excuse. But they always seem to have a reason for anything that was ever cut. Pacing was another big one, movies 4 through 8 as well. You know, it always seemed like they really did care and really did, especially after movie 3, to like explain why things got cut and not adapted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would almost bring in the Game of Thrones comparison here too, because you know the difference is now you have the showrunners going in a direction where they are creating their own story. You know, they're killing off characters who may not be dead in the book series, and you know, I don't think as much there wasn't as much liberty taken with the Potter series. I mean, I think we're all so close to the books that there are, of course, things that we see that we don't really like, things that we would have liked to have been included. But I think as far as adaptations go, they stayed true to the core. And, you know, it, at the end of the day, we may not like the movie itself or a couple of the movies. But I think what Heyman and Yates did, particularly the Yates, because he was there the longest as a director, is they stayed true to J.K. Rowling's writing, same for Steve Clovis. And I think Rowling was such an integral part of what was going on. I think, you know, why you see so much issue, and it may be similar to what you're saying, Andrew, with the Divergent series, is that they've now taken it and they've gone in such a different direction. And I think that that's what angers people more, is that you're messing with the actual story itself.
Yep. Let's move on to our next comment. This is from Diana. She talks about Cursed Child. My biggest struggle was accepting that Voldy and Bella had a child. Spoiler alert.
I guess you should have said that first.
Well, everybody, come on. You got to have read it by now. J.K. Rowling did such a wonderful job tying everything together in the 7 books that it doesn't leave much room for an 8th story where things are added into the original plot. And how did so few people know about this child? And she adds that, I think, so she says, do you guys think this is all coincidence and part of why the writers of The Cursed Child chose this as a viable plot? Or do you think in the back of J.K. Rowling's mind, she planned on Voldemort having a child but never wrote it into the books? So I've wondered about this too. I think we touched on it a little bit on the show here. I want to believe that J.K. Rowling has had this in mind all along, because there were kind of hints in the book that this... We knew that Bellatrix was in love with Voldemort. We never saw Voldemort in love.
Yeah.
And so there's that part of it. Maybe Voldemort was, it sounds weird to say, but looking to celebrate, I don't know.
One of his victories.
His return, yeah, one of his victories by having sex with Bellatrix. I'm just not sure.
Usually he celebrates his returns by making Horcruxes, not babies.
Could it have been that he wanted to have a baby to make a Horcrux?
Maybe Bellatrix wanted to make a Horcrux.
Yeah. I want to believe that J.K. Rowling had this in mind. I would be disappointed if Jack Thorne or John Tiffany went to J.K. Rowling and said, hey, what about Voldemort and Bellatrix having a kid? And J.K. Rowling just shrugged and was like, yeah, okay, sure, fine, we can add that in. What do you three think?
Well, Diana does a good job of kind of laying out some reasoning in terms of timing, and I think that it's difficult to, like you were saying, Andrew, I have a hard time believing it just because of Voldemort, who he was, and the fact that we know that he's incapable of love. So that also paints this as a very challenging situation to try and discuss, because if it's not love, is it a forced situation? Even if it is Bellatrix, who we know is enamored by Voldemort. So I feel like it's a slippery slope to go down to have this kind of discussion. But it's been written and it's part of this play. And I just knowing what we have learned from the books, it just doesn't seem possible to me. So I agree with her that it's probably the most difficult thing to accept out of this story.
I just tend to agree with everything that's been said already.
Yeah, the fact that Voldemort didn't even have hair because he didn't want anyone polyjuicing as him. I can't imagine him wanting to procreate and have an heir. I just can't. He's too...
Well, we all make mistakes.
Now I want a shirt that says, make Horcruxes, Nukes, baby. Not babies.
Oh, yeah.
Is that canon? Voldemort didn't have hair because he didn't want to be polyjuiced?
I swear that's canon. I swear. I'll look that up, but...
Yeah. Oh, and when I say make mistakes, I'm not saying J.K. Rowling made a mistake. I'm saying Voldemort may have made a mistake. Like, it was just maybe a moment of weakness for him. Mm-hmm. And he was like, well, maybe hooking up with Bellatrix would be fun.
Well,
it's
a good question to ask her, though. I would think that's a good question to pose to her, you know, when she comes on the show, or
I thought you guys already
or just in the future, on you know, during one of these events that she does where she takes questions, from fans, because I think it was pretty well established throughout the series and just from other questions that have been posed to her that this was an individual that was not capable of understanding love. So, but Diana does point out she did see The Cursed Child and thought it was really, really good. So she recommends all of us going to see it.
I will check it out.
I will still see it.
We're going to talk about... It. Yeah, you absolutely positively need to see it at some point. I think everybody should. I don't know how yet, but whether it's in New York or whether it's on a DVD, everybody should see it no matter what you thought of the script book. And I think nobody could resist that, I think. What was I going to say about this? Oh, we're going to talk about this a little bit more in Bonus MuggleCast because I've come around a little bit on The Cursed Child. I think my views have evolved. I'm not sure if I'm accepting it as canon anymore.
No.
I'm accepting it like I accepted, like I accept the story in Harry Potter and Forbidden Journey the Ride. It's there for entertainment purposes, and that's it.
Right. Interesting. I think it's freeing if you do that.
We'll talk about that more on Patreon. We're also, by the way, going to talk about the new Pottermore ebooks. Because those came out.
Yes.
And we're going to see what's up with those. What's going on there? But before we wrap up today's episode, we have an email here. Eric, get ready. We're going back to where we were during episode 300.
Oh, no.
This is from Anonymous. They didn't want to reveal themselves. That's how dirty this email is. Kidding.
It sounds like it's from Noah.
Who's Noah? MuggleNet Noah? What are you talking about?
Yeah, he's on Alohomora.
Oh, okay. Dear MuggleCasters, So I was rereading Chamber of Secrets over the weekend, and I came across another instance of where J.K. Rowling may have included a reference to some mature or perhaps immature behavior. The mandrakes. They start out as babies and mature throughout the books until they are mature enough to be used to make the antidote for the petrified students. Page 234 tells us their status in the maturity process. Quote, Madame Pomfrey was pleased to report that the mandrakes were becoming moody and secretive, meaning that they were fast leaving childhood. The moment their acne clears up, they'll be ready for repotting again, Harry heard her telling Filch kindly one afternoon. So they, end quote, so they become more moody, secretive, and have acne? Hitting puberty? I think so. On page 251, we learn a bit more about the mandrake maturity process. Quote, and in March, several of the mandrakes threw a loud and raucous party in the greenhouse tree. In greenhouse three. This made Professor Sprout very happy. The moment they start trying to move into each other's posts, we'll know they'll fully mature, she told Harry. Firstly, they threw a party. Secondly, the mandrakes start trying to move into each other's pots. Wonder what they'll try to do in each other's pots. Sounds suspicious. Looks like the mandrakes want to fool around a bit. What this teaches us is that apparently mandrakes are the only characters to hit puberty throughout the books. No one else does. No other characters get acne or has her period or gets awkward boners or anything like that. Talk about unrealistic characters. So there you go. There's more hidden secrets within the books.
Thank you, Elisa and Laura, for that email.
Eric, what do you make of this? I want to know your opinion on this.
I don't think it's hidden. I think that's actually, it's a source of great joy to read Chamber of Secrets and see that these mandrakes are, it's completely a allegory or metaphor, or yes, these mandrakes are just like human teenagers getting acne and, you know, as they grow, climbing into each other's pots. I guess it's dirty. I guess. It's certainly right to point out that it's something that's unique in terms of the Harry Potter books, sure. But I just find it really funny when you're reading Chamber of Secrets and going through this and seeing that the mandrakes are basically taking on a life of their own. And then because they're still plants, they have to chop them up to save the school. So there's like a really kind of weird cliffhanger where you're like, well, weren't they sentient and should we really be chopping them up right now?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's kind of interesting.
Not a single awkward boner in the Harry Potter series. I was just thinking about that.
Really?
What's up with that?
I don't know.
All right. Well, I'm trying to come up with a joke, but I got nothing. Eric, why don't you wrap up the show today? You're teasing us. So there's been some fun things coming into the P.O. box. What are you talking about?
Yeah, so we have just four items here that I wanted to bring out. I have photos, you guys, so I'm sharing them in the document right now. Insert image. We got just the most artistic and unimaginable photos here of... Actually, no, I took them, but envelopes. The envelope is that I'm looking at right now, which is from Michaela, who is from Winnipeg in Canada, drew an owl on a branch on the front carrying this letter on the front of the envelope. So let me just share this with you guys. Here we go. On the front, it's uploading.
Okay. Oh, cool. And she drew a whole owl.
She drew a whole owl. And then look at what's on the back.
It's a goat.
It's not a goat.
Damn.
It's actually, this is harder to see because I made it too small when I uploaded.
Okay.
But it's a picture of Harry, Ron, and Hermione, and Crookshanks is showing us his butt.
Why is Crookshanks showing us his butt?
I have no idea. Crookshanks is not, I don't know, is spiting Ron or something.
Crookshanks, you got a nice ass.
Yeah. It turns out that, Michaela is 14 years old. And has written us this lovely letter, which I thought I would read because it's short.
I'm sorry for the end of last week's episode, Michaela.
I was hoping you would apologize.
Michaela.
She's really artistic, and wrote this brief letter. I'm unraveling the scroll right now. Hi, I'm Michaela. I'm 14 and I've been listening to your guys' podcast for 7 months now and I love it.
MuggleCast always, with the Deathly Hallows symbol for the A, has the best discussions, and it's always great to listen to different points of views. If I'm ever having a bad day, I just pop in my earbuds and play an episode of MuggleCast and always feel great. Thank you guys for everything. Happy 300th episode. This is a huge milestone from a fellow fan, Michaela C.
Awesome. Well, thank you. That was really sweet.
And then we got, this other insane, mailing from Megan, who's in Tanzania.
Aw, very cute.
It's Dobby, and it says, Happy Birthday, MuggleCast. And she wrote a letter inside, which I will also read here. Hi, my name is Megan, and I am an avid, albeit rather new, MuggleCast listener. I'm currently serving in the Peace Corps in Tanzania. As a biology teacher at an all-girls school in Nyombe, in the Southern Highlands, up in the mountains, shrouded in mist, pretty much exactly the location described for Vagadov. Besides teaching science, my counterpart and I are starting an English reading, writing, and speaking club. Swahili is the main language here, although secondary school is taught in English, and I cannot wait to read the Harry Potter stories with my girls. Last I checked, there was no Swahili version, so we might have to translate it ourselves for fun. Anyway, just wanted to say that Hamjambo, hello to all of you, and Asante Sana, thank you very much, for recording your amazing podcast. Wish I would have started listening to them earlier. Good news is I always have more episodes to listen to. Bad news is it takes me about an hour or so to download one.
Aww.
Looking forward to new episodes. Thank you again, Megan.
Thank you for taking the time to download them. We used to do low bandwidth versions of the show for people on dial-up, but we since stopped doing that. But yeah, thank you. That's really wonderful. It's so nice to hear these stories because it's a reminder for us that there are a lot of people out there listening.
Yeah. And
from all over the world.
Yeah. Two more things. We got a postcard from Shannon, who sent us one of the studio tour owls carrying the letter. So thank you, Shannon. And Jennifer, who wrote actually, or somehow, I can't tell what this, maybe you guys can see in the document what this lettering is. It's not handwritten, or if it is, it's very impressive because she used like
it's calligraphy.
It's calligraphy, like a calligraphy pen, or I don't even know how this is possible. It's an entire letter. It's two huge pages. I won't read it, but it's wonderful. And yeah, so I can't even imagine, but people are taking so much time to send us this stuff, and it's just a pleasure since reopening the P.O. box to receive it. And thank everyone for their well wishes and all of that. I just wanted to give them a shout out on this show.
Awesome. Awesome. So you're saying no live goats though?
No, you know,
or vibrating broomsticks.
Yeah, Dan, who runs the store that the P.O. box is located at, will call me if there's a live goat, I'm sure right away, and expect an explanation.
Hope so.
But he's cool. He's cool, so.
You just hear a goat making noises in the background.
There's a freaking goat here! Who sent you this?
I'll be right over to pick it up, sir.
Yeah, right over.
cool. And our patrons are starting to receive their Patreon t-shirts. I finished the first U.S. wave, internationals next, and then keep chugging along with those over the next few months. So that is that.
Keep posting
Thank you, everybody.
Pictures.
Make sure.
What?
What's that?
Tell them to keep posting pictures of their shirts because they look cool.
Yes. Yeah, they've been, listeners have been, who've received the shirts have been tweeting us. We love seeing them arrive at your doorstep. So continue tweeting us at MuggleCast or share them on Patreon. We'd love to see them there as well. Coming up on Bonus MuggleCast today, like I said, we're going to be talking about the new Pottermore ebooks. What is new there? And we have lots more questions from our patrons. We're going to go through them, just bounce around from topic to topic, see what people want us to answer. There's a lot of good stuff in there. Like I said, our patrons are very engaged. It's very cool.
They certainly are.
Thanks, everybody, for your support. And thanks, everybody, for listening as we enter this next phase of the show where we embark on another 300 episodes.
Woo!
And I am still searching for that vibrating broomstick
right
now. Yeah. Please send me one. One day, we were joking about this before starting recording. One day, you're just going to turn on an episode of MuggleCast, and you're going to hear this vibrating noise from one of our microphones the entire episode. And we're gonna have it on like nothing special is happening. All right. Thanks again, everybody, for listening. I'm Andrew.
I'm Eric.
I'm Micah.
And I'm Gina.
Gina, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you for having me again.
Absolutely. See everybody next time for episode 302. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.